Today, Canberra rejects John Adams' offer to help as more experts predict GFC 2.0. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to our latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. And today I have John Adams with me again. Hello, John. Good to see you.
Hello, sir.
So there's a lot of noise out there and everybody's getting very, very twitchy about the next GFC.
Yes. So we saw an article published this afternoon on news.com.au about the former chief economist at Lehman Brothers, of all places. He has come out in the last week or so to warn that the risk of a new global financial crisis, it is serious and the risks are intensifying. So he is the latest voice in a whole host of international characters, including the Bank of International Settlements and the IMF, who are saying that the global debt bomb is unsustainable and it is getting riskier by the day.
It's worth saying that John Llewellyn, who you're talking about as the Lehman guy, was at Lehman's for 10 years up to the GFC.
Yeah.
So he was effectively the global economist there.
Yes.
And so it was right in the middle of the maelstrom when it all happened.
Indeed, indeed. And I should say that the significance of that story was that news.com.au contacted me this morning because they wanted me to provide some quotes. So there's a concept about doom loops.
I think it's probably worth just spending a bit of time on this because it's not really a new concept, but it's probably a new word, isn't it?
Yes, doom loops. It's a new term, and this chief economist referred to this concept. But basically, what a doom loop is, the phenomena whereby weak banks can stabilize governments that support them, and over-indebted governments can push banks holding their bonds over the precipice. So starting at stage one, you've got a financial bubble. Then you've got rising interest rates. Borrowers struggle to repay, and that's going to put pressure on weak banks. And then when these weak banks get into trouble, you start to see a fall in confidence. Financial panic starts to ensue. That then starts to destabilize governments because these governments have really backed the banks. And you could say to a certain extent, you're seeing this in terms of Italy. The Italian government is heavily in debt. But one of the destabilizing factors in Italy is you've got a whole bunch of weak Italian banks who are getting into strife. And because the Italian government owns some of the debt of those weak banks, that's having some implications in terms of the sort of stability in terms of the Italian government. Although it should be said that with the Italians, they are trying to push a larger deficit more than the EU rules, and that's also having an impact. Well, if the weak Italian banks, just to take Italy as the case study, if the weak Italian banks destabilize the Italian government, if there's a loss of confidence that the Italians can meet and pay their bonds, then you're going to see bond prices on the Italian bonds go down, the yields go up, and then there'll be a question as to how solvent is the Italian government, and basically those banks or the ECB who holds the Italian debt, they're going to start suffering capital losses as the bond prices go down, and then those institutions are going to be sort of in financial peril. From the weak banks get in trouble, then spreading into the government, then spreading into the strong banks. And then if the strong banks get into trouble, that's going to eventually seep into a globally systemically important bank, like a Deutsche Bank or a Barclays in the UK, etc. So that's what we saw leading up to the GFC. Subprime started to blow up. That obviously started then to seep into smaller banks. Then Best Earns fell over, and then basically Lehman Brothers went over in September. So that didn't involve the U.S. government at that point, but that was a bit of a process from small fish leading to a big fish getting into trouble. Whereas this doom loop concept is weak bank affecting government, affecting strong bank, affecting a major fish, and then that fish blowing up leads to a GFC.
And of course, things are even more interconnected than they were a decade ago. Right?
Yeah.
So if you look at the way that the banking system has evolved, right, we've actually got more, for example, derivative exchanges than we have previously. That is actually creating more connectivity rather than than less. We've also got more debt in the system.
Yep.
Right. And the globally important banks are in a deadly embrace with each other.
Yeah.
Right? So it doesn't take much, as you say, for a little fire over here to effectively start spreading, and the contagion moves very quickly. And it's the contagion that really is the critical risk that people are now beginning to wake up to.
Yes.
And it's all centered, actually, about the way that the dollar works, right? It's all centered on the way that the differential interest rates are moving. So, the Fed's putting rates up in the US. That's having a huge impact around the world. And then if you look at the rates of interest that some of those, for example, European countries are now having to pay, it's a lot higher. So as the cost of money goes up, then effectively the pressure in the system just gets greater and greater.
Yes.
So that's effectively what they're talking about.
Indeed. And when you mention contagion, I mean, the really important issue with contagion is any time in the last, say, 6 months where the risk or the whisper of contagion has come up, there's been a rush to play for time. So, for example, when Turkey blew up two or three months ago, they started talking about having some sort of IMF bailout to stop that contagion spreading into the European banking system. You look at Pakistan now. Pakistan's very close they're in an economic crisis at the moment, and they're close to default. So 2 weeks ago, the chatter was that Pakistan would go to the IMF, and then the US basically said to Pakistan, don't you dare take US money to basically give it to the Chinese finances or to the Chinese banks. So now, because there's particularly in a potential US opposition to an IMF bailout for Pakistan, because they don't want the Chinese to get the money, Pakistan's now looking at other countries outside of the IMF to get a bailout. So I get a lot of questions, and even with some of the comments from previous episodes we've done, people want to know when, and the when will be when they can't control the contagion. But for now, anytime there's a small hiccup, they're trying to find a Band-Aid to put over the wound so that contagion doesn't spread.
Mm. The difficulty is, do they understand all the connection points, right? And of course, each time they put another patch on, it's like, I'm running out of hands.
Yes.
So how much longer can this go on for is the key question.
Yeah, yeah. So the concept would be, in terms of having a leaky boat, you're putting a few patches here and there to stop the ship capsizing, but then there's going to be a big hole that you just can't plug, and then that's going to result in the ship falling apart.
Mm.
The conversation among the political elite, the bureaucrats, they're not really focused on any of these things, even though there are systemic risks all over the place. And yet, the phone was running hot with me over the weekend, given the Wentworth by-election, and everyone's just talking politics, they're talking power. No one's talking about the Australian people. No one's talking about the economy. And it's like, well, what is it going to take for people to wake up before it's too late? Hopefully it's going to seep through into political conversation so we can actually get the politicians to actually focus on the needs of the Australian people.
And you could actually say, I think, they really are fiddling while Rome burns, right? It's like global financial crisis coming up. We're not interested, right? We're only interested in our little narrow focus on how do I get re-elected?
Absolutely, absolutely. Right. So yes, so the quote I had was, this is me. I remain as concerned as ever that Australian policymakers have not taken adequate steps to insulate the Australian economy from the coming crisis. The Morrison government is failing in its job to protect everyday, ordinary Australians from severe economic hardship. So that's what I said on the record today, and hopefully more people hear the message, and that it can sort of seep through to the PM and the Treasurer that they need to wake up.
And that's pretty hard-hitting, John.
When I was in the bureaucracy many years ago, and also, when I was working at Parliament, I mean, there was all this thing about, not being too direct, being nuanced, being careful with your words. I think the time for nuance has ended, and we need to, be more blunt. We need to be more frank, with our political leaders, and basically just say, what the hell are you guys doing? Because, someone has to be right, someone has to be wrong. You've got a whole bunch of international bodies and people saying something's wrong, and now establishment from the banks to the RBA to APRA to Parliament saying, no, nothing's wrong. Well, I've taken my position. I know who I'm betting on. And the people who have direct control over our economic well-being just are completely asleep at the wheel.
And it's really interesting, just, you know, touching on the Reserve Bank and the Treasury, right? Because in the last little while, they've come out and basically warned that there is a risk if credit is slowed too much. In other words, if the Royal Commission results come out and as a result of that credit slows, then that's a danger for the Australian economy. To which I think, what? Hang on a moment. They created the problem in the first place, right?
That's right, yeah.
Firstly.
Yes.
Secondly, we are now applying normal lending standards rather than abnormal lending standards, right? Which is why credit is slowing.
Yeah.
And third, the last thing you want to do is to reverse that, because all you're doing is just building the debt bomb even more and kicking the can down the road again. And that's not solving anything. So,
yeah.
So it's like Alice in Wonderland. It's like they're living in a completely different world.
Yes, yes. It's not just like in terms of Alice in Wonderland, but I think you should sort of just make a comment about what the Treasury and the Reserve Bank is doing in terms of putting a submission into the Banking Royal Commission and telling the Commissioner, hey, pump the brakes. We don't want you to do anything that's going to adversely slow credit growth.
Yeah, so you're right. So the Reserve Bank in their financial stability report specifically referred to the risks of credit slowing too fast, right? And as you say, they've also now put submissions into the Royal Commission to basically say, don't restructure the banks too much, don't tighten credit too much, be careful, because there's a danger that if you actually do too much, then effectively you rock the economic credit boat. And just think about that, right? The reason that we've got the boon that we've got is because we've had interest rates way too low for way too long. We've had credit effectively way too available, right? We've blown up the debt balloon. We've got very high debt to income ratio. We've got many households who are in significant difficulty now. And the regulators, the people in charge, are basically saying, no, you can't change that, because if you change that, you bust the economy. That's what they're actually saying.
Absolutely.
It's so nuts.
It's absolutely nuts.
But you've got a bit of history here, haven't you, right? Because
yes.
You actually tried to go and help Treasury some time ago, right?
Yes.
I think it's worth telling that story now, because there's groupthink down there, isn't there, in Canberra? Absolute groupthink.
Yes, yes. Well, it's groupthink, but it's the Keynesian paradigm.
Yep.
And if you want to say anything that is outside of that paradigm, that you basically don't get a look in terms of Treasury. So, September last year, I did actually put in an application. So they were looking to employ a whole host of economists at all, you know, at all sorts of levels, particularly in their macroeconomic division. So I thought to myself, well, because at the time I was writing a whole host of articles for News Limited warning about these things, because my warnings go back to 2016. So I thought to myself, I had a job in Sydney. So it wasn't that I was looking for a job, but I thought, well, could I actually, rather than warn the public, could I actually take these warnings into the heart of economic, the economic department of the government, and actually try to have some influence about the thinking about how are they assessing the economy at the moment, both domestically and in terms of internationally? How are they assessing systemic risk, economic and financial, and obviously try to help, because the role of Treasury is ultimately to provide advice to the Treasurer. And then, you know, if the Treasurer doesn't want to accept the advice, I mean, that is an issue. But I guess, you know, having known several people who have worked at Treasury over the last 5 to 10 years, you know, there is a big risk that the bureaucrats are completely asleep at the wheel, and that they are not attuned to what's really going on. And I think that particularly given that the Treasury and the RBA are trying to tell Commissioner Hayne not to put forward any recommendations that's going to slow credit growth, I mean that's a telling sign. Now, unless if the government, as in the cabinet, has instructed these agencies to put this forward, and they're doing the will of the government, that's one thing. But if there hasn't been any explicit instructions from the government to keep the bubble going, well it seems to me that the risks that a whole host of international people are saying that the bureaucrats they're not attuned to. So basically, I did put an application for an EO1 position. In this application, I mean, to be honest, the cover letter, it was very different to how I would write a cover letter, because it was basically saying, I want to come in, I've been writing these things, I'm very concerned, I want to come in and help you do some very specific things, and I want to help the Australian people. So I'll, without showing the full cover letter, because it goes from page and a half, but there's a couple of key paragraphs that I think that'd be worthwhile to retell the audience, and then I'll actually tell what the outcome of that process was. So the first quote that I had in my cover letter that I'll share with the audience is, I said, in applying for a position within macroeconomic group at the Treasury, I have a specific interest in assisting Treasury to develop an independent institutional view regarding the significant macroeconomic structural imbalances by historical standards which are now observable within the Australian economy. So basically I'm saying the bubble is so obvious, you guys need to develop your own independent thinking so that you can provide the best advice to the Treasury that you can. So given that I can see the bubble and that I've written about the bubble publicly, surely I can provide some value to the thinking of Treasury. So that was one of the quotes I had. Another paragraph I had in my cover letter was, across my independent economic research analysis and public writings, I have expressed a concern that Australia's record high household debt and foreign debt have the capability to put at risk the financial stability and security of millions of Australians in the event of an unanticipated international economic shock. Now, why did I write this specific sentence is because an unanticipated international economic shock is exactly what the GFC was, and they did not see it. So they were blind to it. Now, I think if to be accurate on the historical record, the person who raised the risk of a GFC was actually Kevin Rudd. So there was an ABC documentary that was done after the Rudd prime ministership, and they basically said that Rudd was concerned about what was happening on Wall Street with subprime, and there was this famous, because there was a three-part series, there was this famous scene where Rudd is on the prime ministerial plane and he's asked Ken Henry, who was the Secretary of the Treasury, who's now the chairman of NAB, to come on the plane for a private discussion. So the secretary hops on the plane, and then the Kevin Rudd asks him point blank, how risky is this subprime process and what does that mean for us? And in this part one of this documentary, Ken Henry, he expresses surprise that the prime minister is already talking about some sort of international shock and thought that this commentary from the prime minister was too premature. But then later on in the episode, he says, Kevin Rudd had fantastic foresight. So a little bit concerning that in February, March of 2008, Treasury had no idea, and I have confirmed speaking to people who work for Costello, 2005, 2006, 2007, Costello's office had absolutely no idea. They didn't understand subprime. They didn't understand what was happening on Wall Street. Because I asked someone who was in that office, did you know what was happening? Did you get warnings? And they basically said they took their international references from the key bodies like the IMF, the OECD, blah, blah, blah. No one was expressing alarm from those bodies. So they just thought that everything that was okay. So the Howard government didn't see it. Treasury didn't see it. So that's why, to the extent that they didn't brief Costello or Swan, Rudd was concerned. He raises with Treasury, and they thought he was premature in raising it. So there's definitely groupthink. But if you follow the Keynesian economic framework, you don't understand how bubbles form. You don't have the ability to recognize them when they're in front of you, and you don't really understand how the process can quickly unravel. And so obviously this is where, when you interviewed Steve Keane talked about using non-standard or non-orthodox ways of thinking about economics. So you would have thought that they would want at least a few independent thinkers or people who have dissenting voices to just come in to have a more balanced conversation within the halls of power.
Well, it's interesting because if I work with companies on strategy, right, quite often they deliberately want to think about alternative futures and alternative outcomes and play different scenarios, right? In fact, we quite often war game, right? Yep. Because that's a really good way of testing in different circumstances with different outcomes what might happen. And then you'd think about how would I respond to it, right? That's pretty standard strategic thinking in the private sector.
Yep.
So I'm really surprised that down in Canberra, they don't do that. I would have thought that would have been just normal course of business.
Yes, yes. Well, I mean, so before revealing what happened to me with this application, I'll just read a couple of other sort of paragraphs. So this is a bit of a long one, but I say, I believe more analysis and policy work using alternative theoretical frameworks, you know, consistent with what I was saying about Steve Keen,
yep.
and methodologies is required by Treasury to determine whether current policy settings are appropriate to mitigating the macroeconomic risks associated with the structural imbalances mentioned above, including whether current policy settings are sufficient to reduce excessive levels of consumption, the accumulation of non-government debt, and to reverse the low levels of national savings, which are observable across various public and private sector data sets. So basically what I'm saying is you need people in there to help you come up with different ways of thinking so that you don't have your blinkers on, you're not looking myopic, so you can actually, see whether something is coming over the horizon. So that was another paragraph I had. And then the last one, now this is a stinging one because I thought it was important I actually make the point they didn't see the GFC. Now, you never really tell an employer that you got it wrong. But I said this. I believe a review of Treasury's economic risk assessment framework is warranted given recent problems associated with Treasury's revenue forecasting experience, as well as Treasury's inability to anticipate well in advance the global financial crisis in 2008. Now, one of the reasons why I put this particular sentence in is that people who have very close knowledge of the senior workings of Treasury have told me December last year, that they were very nervous about whether Treasury has fully priced in the risk of what's happening in this economy, but in terms of overseas. And this particular person, who I won't mention, but is quite prominent within Australian public society, basically was of the view then, and he still is of the view now, that Treasury was underestimating the risk of a serious economic event from happening. So I basically say, you've got a pretty poor record in terms of forecasting, in terms of coming up with risk assessments. And given that certain people were telling me that they were concerned about Treasury's ability to look at these risks, I sort of say, well, you missed it last time. It's obviously back here again. You need someone to actually help you think about these things through. That's why I want the job. Now, particularly in the private sector, if someone had a bad commercial experience, and then you have someone coming to get a job and say, "Hey, you lost money on this, but I know how to make you money in the future." Well, a good entrepreneur or a good business owner is going to say, "Well, if you can help me stop making mistakes and you can help me make money in the future, well, I want you on my team." So that's what happens in the private sector. But in public sector circles, if you say you screwed it up and it's obviously going to happen again and I want to come and help you, well, that in Canberra, that in the officialdom is not looked at favorably. So I put in this application thinking, well, knowing how the bureaucracy works, they're particularly not going to like this letter, but I thought to myself, well, why not a chance? Because I thought maybe at least I would get an interview so that I could actually put my case forward to them and then they can sort of make an assessment as to whether they want me in there or not. But I can report to the DFA audience, having put this application in, no interview.
Are you surprised?
To be honest, I was a little bit surprised because I thought just from the perspective of future political management,
yeah.
because part of the reason also why I wrote this was because I wanted to put them on the hook, because bureaucrats in this country, whether it is at Treasury, RBA or in other departments, they never are held accountable. They always say, well, it's kind of like Sir Humphrey. It's always the minister's responsibility, the minister's accountable to Parliament, blah, blah, blah. So they missed it last time and we went through the GFC. They're missing it again. Now, if something that, like, in my view, and I've said this, something is going to happen. So when it does happen, the question is, well, who will be held accountable? Well, if the current government is out of power, none of them are going to be held accountable. If you get a new Labor government, the new treasurer is going to say, well, I didn't cause it. I just got here, so you can't blame me. But the boffins who have been trying to, who have been responsible for providing advice to the ministers, I mean, surely them and the governor of the RBA and the head of APRA, someone there should be held accountable if we do have significant financial hardship for hundreds of thousands, if not millions of Australians. But historically, that hasn't happened. So I wanted to write it in this way so that if they say, what did they say 10 years ago? We didn't see it. We can't be held accountable. Well, I wanted to make sure that if they say it next time, I didn't see it, don't blame me. Well, I want to be able to say, hey, not only have I been writing to say I can see it, I actually tried to come in inside the department to help you, and you basically gave me the cold shoulder.
Fair enough. And it's worth saying, isn't it, that as we said earlier on in this piece, right, the IMF and the BIS and a number of prominent international individuals are all saying there are huge risks in the system.
Yes.
Right? So it's not like last time when those large institutions were silent.
Yes.
Right?
That's right.
They're actually calling it out now.
Yeah.
So that tells me that we're closer to midnight this time.
Yeah.
Potentially. Right? And more people are actually saying we've got issues, and yet we still see precisely the same behaviours inside Canberra, inside the RBA, inside APRA.
Right? Yes.
Which means we can't rely on any of those guys to protect our backs.
No,
that's what it means.
Yeah. So for me, that is an important message for people listening to this in terms of this conversation. Is you cannot, if you think the Australian government is going to be there in your time and in your hour of need, you are mistaken. All the chatter. So on the weekend, I spoke to politicians, members of parliament. I spoke to people in the press gallery. I spoke to former members of parliament. And they're all obsessed with politics, Wentworth, what does this mean for the next general election, who's got what power, Barnaby Joyce wanting the national leadership back after having to resign in disgrace, all of this sort of minutiae. And then we get even today, the Fairfax media reporting about aggressive magpies in Canberra, of all things. I mean, for heaven's sake, the parliament, the politicians and the press need to start reporting on the important issues facing the country rather than talking about, you know, a few magpies swooping a couple of photographers in Parliament House.
Yep. Well, they can always watch our channel and hear the real story, right?
That's right. Absolutely.
Okay. And I, just before we close, I know that the gold thing hasn't gone away, has it?
The gold thing, it hasn't gone away, so it is continuing. So there are quite a few people who watched our part one, and we got a lot of views on part two as well. So a lot of people were very surprised with the commentary, and I think we've taught some new things to people. So I can report, and what I should say is, quite a few people did email the RBA or did email their member of parliament and saying, hey, what is this gold issue about? So the RBA has been in communication with me today. I am going to go back to them with a long list of follow-up questions to really dig into this 11 tons of gold about the leasing. But the interesting thing that they did say to me today that I can report is that as of tonight, still 99.9% of Australia's gold is not in Australia. So 69 tons is in the Bank of England, 11 tons has been leased, but none of it is here. So I'm going to ask some very specific questions about why does it have to be there? Can't we bring it back? Who's the ultimate decision maker? But I guess for these people, for people watching this show who watched part one and part two and went on to YouTube and basically said, I want our gold to be back in this country. Well, I don't think the RBA and the government's going to volunteer to bring that back. So if people want it back, they have to apply, maximum political pressure. I think they need to be involved in the process. They need to learn what's going on. So once I get some more information about this 11 tons, I'll come back on this show with Martin to talk about that. But if people don't want their gold overseas and they want it back in this country, just like a whole bunch of Eastern European and Asian and Asian countries are doing, then we basically have to sort of take up the reins and basically say to the bureaucrats, well, this is our country. You're not going to control this situation. We demand that you bring our gold back to Sydney.
Good. Well, stay tuned on that one.
Yes.
And let me just give you an update, right? Because the other thing we've been wrestling with is bail-in.
Yeah.
Right? And I've got a few updates there, right? Since we did our programs on bail-in, I've had quite a large number of people who've actually been in touch with me about letters they've written, some of them a little while ago, to various parts of the bureaucracy, be it, you know, MP, be it Prime Minister, be it RBA. What's fascinating is that there's a consistent pattern coming back, which is that most of the politicians either don't know about bail-in still,
mm-hmm.
or indeed have denied that bail-in exists at all in any form whatsoever.
Yeah.
Right? Despite what everything that we've said and despite that bill that was passed earlier in the year. What's also interesting is that a couple of the banks have now said that they are happy to talk about the bail-in, right? Mm-hmm. So I've now prepared a bunch of questions, and I've sent those questions to a number of the banks specifically to ask for their position on bail-in. So when I get some replies on that, we'll come back and we'll talk some further. So
that will be very interesting.
The bail thing, the bail-in thing is still there. And I guess what that takes us to, you know, all the way through this is, you can't rely on CAMGRU, you can't rely on the RBA, you can't rely on APRA. So we got
and you can't rely on the banks.
No, exactly right. So we got to try and dry some of this stuff to try and actually get the better outcomes.
Yes.
Which is what we're trying to do.
Indeed.
So hopefully, watch this space.
Absolutely.
John, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
So there you are. Another update. Some more questions. We'll be back soon. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Thanks for watching. Do share the post if you like it, and we'll see you next time.